and painted the snow. Or, as an alternative, we're making the hills from state, from 2 to, from 3 to 5. Here.
Yeah.
From 2. Idea came into my mind that while teaching you in my lessons, I'm becoming easier and easier. So I decided that we should return to some scholarly discipline, which includes in itself necessity and very heavy work to understand something. Yes? Yes. For instance, how many of you attended that brilliant lecture by Professor Norman from Cambridge? Nobody?
Yes.
Even?
Which one?
Yes. I was the first one.
The second one I found much easier, I have to say.
Of course, because it was far less interesting than the other. Yes. Anyway, it was a very interesting first lecture. It was brilliant indeed, because he didn't try to be understandable. Yes. And so, but now I would like to return to one thing which seems to me both difficult and immensely interesting. Speaking of the changes which occurred in the middle of the first millennium BC, I more or less in detail draw your attention to what we call the rise of Hinduism, yes, the rise of Buddhism, the rise of Jainism, to which I return further. But there was one other very, very important change to which I would like to devote this lesson today. And that change, as most of really, really important and determining culture changes, undoubtedly occurred spontaneously and imperceptibly for those who lived at that time. That change I am going to speak to you about today probably took at least a couple of centuries to be, as it were, completed. And I would call it as the beginning of a written tradition. Hitherto, as I explained to you in my first lesson, yes, 3 months, when I was at least 3 months younger, you know, India was a classical country of oral tradition. You know, you should understand the strength of that factor. That is, try to imagine now the beginning of the first millennium BC. Yes. We have ancient India. We have ancient Egypt. We have ancient Mesopotamia. We have ancient Persia. We have ancient Anatolia. We have a lot of other ancient And all of them, with one exception, were the cultures and the countries with very ancient written culture. What do we have? What do we have in Mesopotamia? At least seven written cultures, starting with Akkadian. What we have in the Eastern Mesopotamia? What? We have probably the most ancient written tradition in the world,
Sumerian.
To wit, Sumerian. Yes? Now there are even some highly hypothetical, but in my opinion, very interesting suggestions that all other great cultures borrowed their writing from Sumerians. Even ancient China, more than that, even ancient Egypt. So we may say that they started writing somewhere in Sumer, somewhere in the, probably in the beginning of the fourth, or even somewhere in the fifth millennium BC. Yes, can you imagine? And in ancient Egypt, definitely there was a system of hieroglyphic writing as far back as in the end of the fourth millennium BC. And in ancient China, undoubtedly, the beginning of writing must have occurred somewhere in the end of the fourth. At the beginning of the third millennium BC. And in Akkadian culture, from the very start of the third millennium BC, yes, we have writing practically in all ancient cultures. Yes. And it is hard business to say that. Because the second half is, what did they write? What? Mind it, it's a very important question. Speaking of Egyptian culture, for instance, they write about everything. We have economic manuscripts, yes, and stone carvings, political, military, religious, mythological, yes, literary, magical, that is, all spheres of culture were covered in ancient Egypt by writing. Okay, the same in Mesopotamian region, the same in ancient China. And it was at the time when there was no writing in India and all traditions were oral, starting with the great Vedic tradition. To make this feature of ancient Indian culture more, shall we say, relevant, because I would like to draw your attention to one thing now, ladies and gentlemen. To me, oral tradition of ancient India was not a deficiency. It was not the absence of written tradition. It was an absolutely self-sufficient cultural value called oral tradition. And it was oral, not because they could not write. Later on, in the first half of the first millennium BC, they could write and they did write, but their sacred traditions remained all oral. Because unlike ancient Egypt, unlike ancient China, unlike ancient Akkad, unlike ancient Elam, writing when it appeared to need, from the same source, by the way, again from the Middle East, from the absolute same source, when it appeared in ancient India, it was used only for matters profane. Economic documents, political documents, that is, all economics, politics, you know, all the things which, as you can easily understand, have no real cultural value.
Yes.
Can you imagine economics with mythology? You can't, yes. Or politics with religion, I mean a real religion, not the Church of England. Of course, you can't, yes. I'm not joking, I'm deadly serious. On the whole, I'm a very serious man. And more than that, we see very clearly how that writing in ancient India, the first systems, Brahmi, Kharoshti, and the derivatives, which was employed in all practically spheres, and that is why we know almost nothing about that, how that system, or rather several systems, developed until the time when the sacred traditions, or some of them, started becoming written, and more often than not, while remaining oral too. For instance, let us take the great Vedic tradition. The first written Vedic texts. Well, we can hypothetically ascribe, but you have to take into account what factor in India? Climatic factor. What was the material for writing
Parchment?
Wood.
Slate. Clay.
Palm leaves. Mm. Of course. Sometimes they survive the climate, sometimes they don't. But say conjecturally, the Vedic tradition started using writing somewhere probably after Imperial Guptas, somewhere in the 6th or 7th century AD. So before that it existed for almost for 2000 years in its oral form, yes? Mm-hmm. After that it continued to exist in both forms. Even now the great scholars in the Vedic tradition, they know by heart all the Vedas, yes? By oral tradition, while using written sources all along. Now I would like to explain to you some moments of difference in oral tradition, between oral tradition and written tradition. Mm. But, you know, the thing is, again, that the problem of spheres of culture, which of them are and which are not covered by writing, it is a very difficult problem. And sometimes we are present at extremely, I must say, comic episodes. Just recently in Moscow there was an international conference devoted to the earliest period of ancient Russian language. And it was about 45 or 50 years ago that the first specimens of ancient Russian language on, I forgot that term, archaeological term, written on what? Wood. Well, on some wooden planks, shall we say, very ignorant communication, but I'm terribly sorry. And you know, the conference was about 6 months ago, and a lot of scholars were attracted all over the world because it was extremely interesting. All 600 and something planks were deciphered and translated. All of them all of them belong to purely economic sphere. Trade documents, agreements, contracts, a little of politics, only a little, only in connection with trade and taxation, of course, partly. So, 600 documents. And one American scholar, who was a sort of president of that conference, sort of very, very talented philologist, he started his paper saying, now we see that the use of writing appeared there probably somewhere in the end of the 8th century, AD. And the only task and scope of that element of culture was economics. Traders and merchants used it, and we clearly see that the rest of population simply they did not use it because they were illiterate. Speaking literally, but because they had no need to use it because it was traditionally used only within one very narrow functional sphere. And then there was an explosion, there was a bomb on that conference. One, a friend of mine appeared who showed the slides of just recently found a very big letter from the same place, Novgorod, where one unmarried woman implored one warrior to leave his wife and to come to her. It was the most the oldest Russian love letter.
Oh.
It was very long, very touching. So, poor American scholar, everybody realized, of course, simply there were a lot of private letters and probably folktales and God knows what. So far, we did not discover it, our archaeologists. That's it, you know? So, sometimes it is very conjectural what writing does and what writing does not. I read this letter. God, it was marvelous. It was very beautiful. And in a way, I am an adamant person. But even I, in the place of that warrior, I would have been not only touched, but persuaded. Yes, in spite of my adamantine heart and complete indifference to young and beautiful women. But letter, you know, it was indeed a piece of literature, quite a piece of literature. Anyway. Let us return to ancient Indian tradition. The fact that religious texts, that the sacred texts were not written, was not hidden. It is not a conjecture. We find it in the text. And in black and white it is said, that the most sacred things should not be written. They should be only existing as sounds. Because the most sacred thing in ancient Vedic tradition was sound. Yes. And the fact it is of extreme importance. Whereas in Near Eastern region, in Egypt, for instance, in Akkadian culture, in Hittite culture, it was not sound, but word.
The meaning of the word.
Letter. Letter. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, that linguistically speaking, sound and letter are two totally different things.
Wasn't the ancient Hebrew originally sound?
I am absolutely sure that ancient Jewish culture was absolutely Near Eastern through and through. It did not differ in this respect. The main thing for ancient Jews was external form of written word. Letter. Word with its meaning, okay, but not sound. In ancient India it was sound. And that is why there is no other culture where you will find so many mantras. Do you know what mantra is? You know, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Do you? Yes. Tell me what mantra is.
It's the repetition of sort of seed vowels that have particular frequencies that are suitable to different people. So they therefore sometimes appear unintelligible to other people.
One moment. I'm terribly sorry. To comprehend what you said, we now need to know very badly, what seed vowels means.
All right. Okay.
And why vowels? Not only vowels, consonants, too, for heaven's sake. So, what is mantra? Please.
Magical, oral sign, a sign that's believed to produce effect.
Well, it is partly right.
Sacred speech.
It is definitely wrong. Because there are a lot of sacred speech which is not mantra. No more of us.
Chanting.
You can chant a novel, you can chant a political slogan, you can chant a religious hymn.
Wait a minute. This aspect of
it is right, but it does not explain what mantra is. No more of us. David, you disappoint me. It simply means that I am exemplarily bad teacher, you know.
It's a magical formula.
It's got a frequency, hasn't it?
Each and every human word, when produced, has its frequency. Yes. Your speech has its frequency. Mine too. So, no more suggestions. Ladies and gentlemen, I am deeply ashamed. It simply means that you haven't had so far a really good teacher in that discipline. Mantra is a combination of sounds which has no meaning in ordinary language. That is, it is a combination of sounds which cannot be included into a dictionary, left side, with its meaning right side. You may say, oh, yes, what owl denotes? the most sacred mantra. It denotes if it isn't Buddhism, it denotes what? David.
Each letter.
Oh, it is in fact one letter, yes. But doesn't matter.
Yeah, it is.
It's
no, it isn't. Not any Devanagaries. It's one.
Three sounds put together, which each represents.
No, they don't have an A, U, and M in Devanagaries.
Yes, they do.
They don't.
Oh, we've talked about that. This is fun. I didn't even hear that.
I like exactitude.
It means nothing. You just said that.
You are almost on the target. Of course, it denotes in the first place everything, which means magic. It denotes cosmos with all its gods and deities. It denotes the Vedas. Then in Buddhism, it denotes the Dharma and the whole cosmos. So when something denotes everything, then it is not a word. Yes? Mm. And you cannot include it into Oxford Dictionary, say arm in the left side and in the right side everything. It does not mean everything. Arm is out, you know? Simply, it may denote all that there is, but it is not a regular lexicographical denotation. And it exists as a sacred magic combination of sounds. That's it. It is meaningful only in terms of non-definitional sphere of religion. There are a lot of mantras, several hundred, but not only that. Under the category of mantras, we have thousands of normal words and their combinations, which lose by becoming mantras their normal and become non-normal. So, non-normal meaning cannot be included into OED, Oxford Dictionary. It can't, yes? If we agree that, for instance, David, you and your beloved, yes? If you agree that I-L-Y means I love you, yes, nobody would understand around, yes. It wouldn't be a mantra, it would be an acronym. Mm. Because if I am a good decipherer working in intelligence service or another equally superfluous organization, yes, then of course I would even say, oh, it is very simple. It is somebody else's very primitive, ideologically primitive cipher. Yes, but if instead of that, you and your beloved would choose an absolutely neutral word, like, for instance,
potato,
exactly, and use it in the sense of I love you, and say cucumber will be used in the sense of I do not love you anymore. And if those sounds would produce an absolutely adequate effect, we may say that they would become a kind of mantra. Now you understand what mantra is. Mantra may denote anything, or nothing, or all the things in the universe. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, let me come to the second point. The second point is that the long practice of oral tradition usually determines some elements of culture. Which ones? This is a very, very important point. In oral tradition, any text, whether it is one line or a quarter of a line, or now in its reading form, 5,000 or 10,000 pages as the whole Mahabharata, the whole text is measured in terms of what? Time. For instance, even at the beginning of the 20th century, in the oral folklore of half-Buddhist, half-local Mongol Buryat tradition, the length of a text was measured by the time of its performance. A couple of bards are invited to a wedding ceremony, or a yearly celebration of the coming of the future Buddha Maitreya, to recite the sacred texts and then to recite the great epic of the greatest Mongol, proto-Mongol Tibetan hero, what? Kesa, yes. And the villagers ask each other, oh, it is a long story. Oh, yes, 15 days. It will be performed during the 15 days. Oh, it is a short story. It is Diamond Sutra, Vajaj Haidika Prajnaparamita. Illiterate villagers were listening to it in Tibetan language, which they do not. But those who recited, they know, as well as all villagers do know, that if you listen to this text, then you will become stronger. Then you won't die by a bad death. Your death will be timely. It will be propitious. It will be quiet. For a young man, their marriage will be successful and happy. For women striving, aspiring to have children, they will have a lot of them, and all of them boys, strong boys, etc., etc. You understand that the inner meaning of Vajraj Haidika Prajna permit highly complex philosophical and religious texts has nothing to do with those aspirations. Yes. It is about shunyata. It is about the idea of Buddhahood. It is about the dharmas and other totally incomprehensible matters. But it is a sacred text. So, oral tradition maintained that usage of participation of all people, men and women, children and old men, without any knowledge of language, yes? But you should listen. Your process of listening becomes sacred itself. Even you do not understand a single thing. It's a very important feature of oral tradition. You not only listen, you spend your time in fact, not only the text is measured by time, yes, but time becomes being measured by texts. I visited one woman. She was not illiterate. She knew Tibetan and classical Mongol. In Transbaikalian region, at that time, she was 98 at that time. And each day, she was listening to her granddaughter, who recited Diamond Sutra approximately 5 times per day. Mind it, in English translation, it is around 45 pages. So during her life, she heard Diamond Sutra more than 100,000 times. And when I asked her whether she was happy, she said, "I am the happiest woman in the world because all my life was what? Full of divine sounds." Now, let me pass not to those who use the oral tradition, but to those who reproduce it from generation to generation. A lot of highly qualified people called pupils do what? Transmit from their teachers to the next generation a number of texts. So all the Vedic, Upanishadic, Aranyaka, Brahmana texts were transmitted in oral tradition for centuries and for millennia. From teacher to pupil, pupil becomes teacher, from teacher to pupil, pupil becomes teacher, from etc., etc., ad infinitum, with an absolute exactitude. The number of mistakes in oral tradition is considerably lesser than the number of mistakes in any written tradition. You may say, "Oh, now we have computerized system." Ask any editor in any publishing house. As a final result, the number of mistakes after total computerization of the biggest publishing houses in London became much bigger. Because you have to check too many things, including the work impeccability of computer itself. Yes. But, you know, it is quite normal thing. When we say creation, when we say universe, when we say cosmos, when we say our social, private, political, scientific, scholarly life, it implies what? Mistakes, yes. When there is no mistakes, there is no life. But speaking comparatively, oral tradition was impeccable. The first extremely important cultural consequence of the development of oral tradition was that each text was interiorized in the mind of its what? Transmitter. Of its transmitter. When you do not write, when you do not read, you have only two forms of preserving, maintaining, and continuing the text. To it, sound form, yes, and what? Inner form of thinking. But don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, that all those texts, in order to be transmitted from generation to generation, have to be what? Adapted for such transmission. Mm. you think, for heaven's sake, that the text is the same in oral and in written tradition? It is not. In oral tradition, we need some what? Means to facilitate what? Its memorization and its, when necessary, recollection. So, the oral texts were by necessity what? Far more repetitive and far more rhythmic. Because they were absolutely sound oriented. Yes? But not only their reproduction in sound form, but any operation with them, I stress this fact, was not only interiorized, that takes place in your mind, not on the piece of paper or palm leaf or stone slab, yes, but it was realized only in terms of time. It was inner time. But you see your texts in terms of its continuation as you hear or listen to the music. The element of space is hardly noticeable. Now, our idea of text is absolutely spatial, yes? This big, beautiful book, yes? Or small book, or a page, yes? Good handwriting, good print, bad handwriting, bad print. Illuminated manuscript, dirty, old, worn out manuscript. All our qualities are by necessity material, yes, visible, palpable. In oral tradition, it was absolutely not so. It was inner text, which was worked out, studied, commented upon, understood or misunderstood within one's mind to be transmitted from generation to generation. You understand this? And it takes a lot of work. And it necessitates what? An special technique of memorization. What we call now mnemotechnics, yes? And that technique of memorization and recollection was immensely developed in ancient India, because there was no other prop, yes, for text. Only your inner technical method of preserving it, or thinking upon it, and continuing it. It continued in the time of your thinking, of your memorization. Oh, I'm absolutely sure that that technique, in fact, coincided with or was the main cause of one other specifically Indian phenomenon, that of yoga. What does it mean, yoga? Inner concentration. And try to remember first and then recollect spontaneously, second, a text, a length of, say, in English language, 15,000 pages, yes? Try to do that. It takes a lot of effort, but first of all, it is impossible without, on the one hand, adaptation of text to memorization and recollection. And on the other hand, and first of all, adaptation of one's mind to its memorization and recollection, which in fact is yoga in a nutshell. Speaking historically, it would be very interesting to imagine a picture which may be present to the eyes of curious historian. Shall we say, somewhere at the very beginning of the second millennium BC, it was a time when one group of most ancient Indo-Iranian tribes decided to leave for good their homeland somewhere in the central or western Persia, yes, and to travel far away. It was somewhere, roughly speaking, conjecturally, but still more or less correct estimation. It was, say, 20th century BC, yes. They parted from other Indo-Iranian tribes at that time and started moving from western Iran. Do you see the map now before your eyes?